Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, September the 6th. And we will talk about a big idea this hour, that America is on the brink of a new renaissance, a cultural movement driven by the cultural consumer. And it's going to change our communities and our businesses and the marketplace at large. We will talk about the RenGen, short for Renaissance Generation, this hour. It's a cultural movement created by the confluence of art, education, entertainment, and business. And we will welcome your participation, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Find out if you're a cultural consumer. You probably are. Patricia Martin is president of Lit Lamp Communications Group. She partnered with Microsoft to help build what is now the Gates Library Foundation. And she is author of the new book, RenGen, Renaissance Generation, The Rise of the Cultural Consumer and What It Means to Your Business. And she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
This is pretty exciting. You say this is we're going to be experiencing a sea change here.
Yes, we are. Actually, we're on the verge of a second renaissance.
Yeah, and exactly what is this renaissance?
Well, let's have a look at, if we can, sort of go back to the Italian Renaissance and see where the comparisons can be made.
Mm-hmm.
In any renaissance, there are a handful of features that are occurring in the civilization. And the first is that it's a rule of a renaissance that death comes first. So the civilization is in the period of decline. So in Rome, for instance, right before the renaissance, the population of Rome itself had declined to 50,000 people. The Palatine Hill that housed the emperors, was defunct, and sheep grazed on the Palatine Hill, and a brain drain had occurred. All the brains had left Rome and were housed in Florence. And there was a particular feature that was very interesting about this sort of sense of decline, and that was captured by the chroniclers, who would, be compared today to the media. And they wrote from Florence that what was most devastating to Rome was not necessarily the corruption of the emperors or overreaching or any of that. What was really at the heart of the decline was a loss of Roman political will. And when Romans began to believe that they could no longer individually make a difference in their society and effect change, they lost a lot. They lost their sense of drive. They lost their sense of striving. They lost the essence of what made them Roman.
And so, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. So, I read the papers, I look around, I travel the country, and people are saying this to me, that they're feeling a lack of efficacy in their own, in their own communities. And so that's one of the features of a renaissance, is that you sort of have this dispirited sensibility. But that is also sort of fused with, or the paradox that lives with that, is there is then this sort of rise of people being able to express themselves. And it's sort of a mashup, if you will, in the civilization, and it creates a certain amount of creative tension. And so that's the flip side of this. We're seeing 60 million people contribute their creative product on things like YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that is evidence of this this new renaissance coming, is this type of expression?
Yes, there's a huge outpouring of creativity. That's another feature of a renaissance. And so that means that every man gets a voice. In the Italian Renaissance, and we can even say across Europe, this manifested itself in a lot of interesting ways. It'll be interesting to see how it ultimately manifests this second time around. But for the European Renaissance, what occurred is individuals, for instance, believed that they could deal directly with God. They didn't need an interpreter or a go-between. This was huge. This led to the rise of Protestantism. right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, that sort of rise of humanism we see that playing out. We see it especially playing out in the younger generation, who are very driven to make a difference and make a personal contribution to the society.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more of who is the cultural consumer exactly?
The cultural consumer, the first thing you need to know about the cultural consumer is they see themselves as being bright, competent, expressive people. So anybody who's going to go out in this Ren-Gen and market to people as if the average Joe is below average is not going to succeed. So we have been fed for 30 solid years in this country the idea that the average Joe is below average and needs to be marketed to as if they're, frankly, stupid. And where we've seen people start to get traction by giving the average Joe a little bit of credit is in cases like Absolut Vodka. Absolut Vodka, actually, they're original intent for their advertising campaign was to reach an elite. What they didn't understand is there was so much hunger in the marketplace for sort of bright, more intellectually challenging advertisements that they not only became the number one selling vodka in America, they devastated an entire competitive category. The beer industry woke up 2 years ago and found that they had lost 53% of their market share.
And so the Absolut Vodka marketed to this cultural consumer.
Yes, they marketed to the cultural consumer. They gave them a little bit of credit, and they did some really interesting things. First of all, they asked Andy Warhol to hand paint an ad. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, they began hiring lots of artists after Andy. And Andy would tip them off to the edgiest artists to do. Then they started, you know, they hired somebody to design a dress for them, and it became all interwoven in this sort of creative expression. I think the other thing that is important to understand about this Ren-Gen, this cultural consumer, is the cultural consumer now expects to have a voice in the whole process. And let's, you know, Joy, let's not underestimate this, because I think it's a real crescendo moment in our civilization at large. For once, for the first time in our history as a human race, mass media is collaborative. It's participatory. You not only have the messages put out to you, you get to make it a dialogue. And I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell how this will all manifest. But I do believe, and I think the research points to it, that something that is that profound, will have lasting and enduring impact on the civilization.
Well, Ren-Gen also talks about this second renaissance taking place in a number of cities right now, like Seattle and your town of Chicago. How is the second renaissance showing itself in Chicago?
Well, first of all, I always feel like I have to offer a disclaimer about Chicago, because people say, well, you know, weren't you a little prejudiced, considering that you live in the town? And the answer is absolutely, because I have more information about Chicago. But my researchers who collaborated with me on the book, you know, they held that whole thing to a high standard. And the standard is this. This is the standard we set for a renaissance. A Ren-Gen city. A Ren-Gen city, first of all, has to have catalytic personalities. That means people who are willing to sort of shake it up. They knock down naysayers. They build big, bold, beautiful visions. And they make it so. In Chicago, we had Mayor Richard Daley, who looked around, and if he had to look one more day at the blight that was Millennium Park before it became Millennium Park, he hired some architects to create a new plan for it. Called John Bryan, who was the CEO of Sara Lee at the time, a visionary man, a master patron of the arts, and said, have a look at these plans, John, and see if you can help me raise the money for this. John Bryan looked at the plans and said, no, there's not a speck of inspiration in this. It's not big enough. It's not bold enough. And that kicked off this whole planning process that involved eventually people like, you know, Frank Gehry contributed the design for the band shell. Now Millennium Park is this gem in the city. It's revitalized the city, but there are other things besides these catalytic people. There have to be lots of ways to learn. So, you know, having a good university system, having a good public library system, having a museum system, all of these things are sort of bedrock. A good circulatory system within a dense population, meaning that if people are crammed together, but they move freely about, you know, good transportation system, good pathways, even, you know, foot pathways, it facilitates the exchange of ideas, but it also facilitates this other thing. It's sort of an idea, if you will, that the Romans coined. It's called civitas. Civitas is really people living together happily in a civil society, even though they come from very different tribes. And, you know, having a sort of dense and but good circulatory system helps for that. And then there have to be green initiatives. We didn't find in any of the cities that looked like they were, you know, Renaissance cities, and that was Providence, Rhode Island, Chicago, Illinois, Philadelphia, and Seattle. They all had green initiatives, and they were, finally, they were affordable. We had to knock out cities like San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles. They've just simply become too expensive for artistic, literary, intellectual types who also sort of feed ideas into the system.
I need to hold you here for a second. We will continue talking with our guest, Patricia Martin, author of RenGen, Renaissance Generation, The Rise of the Cultural Consumer and What It Means to Your Business. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Is America an intellectual and cultural wasteland defined by reality TV and fast food? Well, our guest says absolutely not, that we are on the brink of a new renaissance, and it's going to change our communities and our businesses and the marketplace in general, and in essence change the way we live our lives. We'll talk more about the cultural consumer and the rise of the cultural consumer, the Renaissance generation, coming up in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. And after 5 o'clock, Ben talks with the author of War and the Soul, Healing Our Nation's Veterans from Post-Traumatic Stress. That's after 5 this afternoon. We're talking with the author of RenGen, The Rise of the Cultural Consumer and What It Means to Your Business, Patricia Martin. She is president of Lit Lamp Communication Group, partnered with Microsoft to help build what is now the Gates Library Foundation, talking with us about what the RenGen is and the cultural consumer. And give us some nuts and bolts, Patricia Martin. What evidence is there that this cultural consumer is a key factor here? How do we know that that there are more of us, the rise of the cultural consumer? What evidence is there that this is going on?
That's a great question, Joy. You know, that's a sort of another myth that I think the American population has been fed for a long time, and it just needs some updating. For instance, there was more foot traffic in this country at historical sites, museums, zoos, and aquariums last year than all the professional sporting events combined, including auto racing.
That did surprise me.
Yeah. And, you know, applications to art schools and the return to, there were more kids who signed up to be liberal arts majors last year than applied as business majors to colleges. So you're seeing sort of a real shift in what people want to know and how they want to learn it. And you're also seeing sort of a rise of expression. I mean, we talked about YouTube, but I think there are other things. For instance, sort of a cult experience for a lot of teenagers in this country is doing things like poetry slams. We encountered a fascinating piece of work that was done actually by a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Constance Steinkuhler. She's quite a visionary, and she did a two-year ethnographic study on multiplayer online games. And she followed these gamers and really sort of got into their heads and figured out, you know, what was driving them to participate. One little story stood out for me is that she, you know, followed this young man who became sort of a global hero, if you will. You know, he was 12 years old, and he sort of really conquered the game. And this was not just a shoot-em-up game where it's grinding level after level over how many people you'll kill. This was a game that was much more elaborate in the kind of tribes and civilizations that you had to create for yourself in order to succeed. So after he had, you know, reached the highest level of mastery, he emailed her to tell her about his victory, and she said, well, what are you going to do to celebrate? And he said he was going to write a short story from the voice of his avatar, you know, his online personality, and he was going to post that on his blog. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was 12, I don't know about you, I wasn't necessarily thinking in those terms.
I never heard of a blog.
Right. We didn't have our own blogs, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that's just a snapshot.
Yeah. Now, is the Ren Gen the young generation, or, you know, is it a fuddy-duddy like me that likes to do cultural things? Am I also part of the Ren Gen?
You know, I get asked that question quite a bit, especially when I'm out on the road talking. And it is actually usually somebody with silver threads in their hair says, you know, am I in?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is yes. In fact, sociologists or anthropologists would define a generation as a 30-year swath of individuals living contemporaneously. Okay. Well, in this case, yes, that's true. However, there is more activity, if you will, in the younger rising generation between 16 and 28. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's the boomers. The 30 to 39-year-olds sort of hollow out.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a bookended phenomenon.
Let me go to the phones. Lots of callers interested in this. Amy in Appleton, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a fascinating mm-hmm. topic today. I wanted to call in with a bit of a personal experience. I am 10 years and 12 years older than two of my younger sisters. I went to school for engineering because it was sensible. And they went to school, one's a jewelry designer and one's an advertising executive who worked in Chicago. And about 5 or 6 years ago, she started talking about this while she was there, but not calling it Ren Gen. But speaking of the creative energy in Chicago and what it had the potential to do, and I was the damp cloth, you know, trying to insert a bit of reality in, well, Amanda, you know, this isn't really how it's going to work out. Well, she's now in London working for an advertising agency, and to hear this topic today, it's got me, you know, of course, ready to call her and say I was wrong. So she, and I really see, as far as this generational thing, I mean, I understand the 30-year gap, but, you know, I'm raising 3 sons, and I'm in the Midwest, and I'm, you know, running the football games and whatnot, and it is wonderful to have the energy from younger people, and I see a lot of her friends and her peers that, you know, I keep in touch with through them. They're choosing these incredible energy-driven creative opportunities, and they're putting off families, they're putting off getting married. There is a power in this that has such a huge potential to change the tide of what, I mean, I'm a bit jaded. You know, I feel mm-hmm. like our politics are corrupt and whatnot, and I look to them, and I really feel hopeful again.
Mm. Patricia Martin?
Yes. You know, I feel it, too, and I think that was one of the most inspirational points. I go across the country, and I have to tell you, people, you know, they're inspired, but at the same time, they're still feeling very cynical. And I say, look, never have we been at this time, you know, in a long time when an individual can make a contribution that collectively then sort of adds up, and we have a facilitating medium now to do that, which is the Internet. You know, I had this encounter one of the things that sort of kicked off the book, writing of the book, I had been in this niche in Chicago, even though my firm is national. And, you know, I was happy in my little niche. And then one day I, you know, hear that David Sedaris is coming to Chicago, and I think to myself, well, I should buy tickets. And the next day it was sold out.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and I'm like, how does... Okay, his act, if you will, is standing in front of a microphone and reading from his book, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how does he sell out a 5,000-seat auditorium in 24 hours?
Yeah, so how does he do that?
He does that because there's a shift. And people are finding that kind of experience something that they're striving for and is life-enhancing, right? So I finally... near the end of my research, I tracked David Sedaris down, sat down with him, and I asked him, you know, why are you so popular? And he wasn't sure of himself, although he did believe that public radio played a big role in it.
You bet.
You bet, Joy. Yeah. But the other thing was this. He told me this story about his personal power. You know, he didn't see the collective thing. It was more about each individual transaction. So he had a guy wait 6 hours at a Borders to get his book signed, and when he came up to the table, he set his hand out on the table, and that hand was tiny. It was like the hand of a five-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
David Sedaris, being who he is, said, oh, that's a tiny little hand.
He just points this out? Yeah.
He just points this out. Mm-hmm. I said, David. He said, well, you know, he put it in front of me. I figure he wants me to deal with it. So he took his time, and he wrote a very detailed message to the man about courage. And when he handed the book to the man stood and read it. And he looked into David Sedaris' eyes, and he said, thank you. Thank you. And Sedaris said to me, that's my power. It's one transaction at a time.
Yeah. Tell us, try to help us understand, though, why David Sedaris selling out in 24 hours in this type of, I guess, demand by the cultural consumer, how this is going to change things. We're not going to see as many McDonald's ads anymore, or we're not, our leisure activities are going to change dramatically with this RenGen. How is this going to change things?
Well, what you're going to see is, you know, I'll use an internet term. You're going to see a big mashup. It's already occurring. If the 20th century was defined by fission, and that is the splitting up of things, the segmenting of things, then the 21st century is going to be defined by fusion. Tony Jones, who's the president of the School of the Art Institute, put it to me this way. The defining art form of the 21st century will be collage, and that's a coming together of lots of different things. So will McDonald's go away? No, but McDonald's will foster other Chipotles, if you will, in order to reach into this RenGen. And RenGeners, by the way, will occasionally eat at McDonald's, and they will consider it bedrock to their civilization, but they'll also want something else. So this whole idea of sort of fusing things, meaning if somebody likes hip-hop, they don't want to be told that they're not a target for opera.
Mm.
I interviewed a guy who was an undertaker, and he, you know, he has this beautiful storefront, and he is like he's like a wedding planner, only it's for funerals. So boomers go in, and they sort of customize their whole farewell to the world. And I asked him, I said, you know, this is a big milestone in someone's existence that they're, you know, they're now passing on. And so I'm sure it's, you know, laden with a lot of tradition. He said, yes, it is. But he said, I've never seen a Catholic, for instance, who didn't want last rites and a priest to say the prayers. Mm-hmm. However, they also want their drumming circle and their yogi to say a few words.
I guess that's a change, yeah. Yeah. Well, let me go to Tim in Ladysmith. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, interesting program. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm not quite as optimistic as your guest. To me, I see our culture spiraling more and more into an amazingly narcissistic society where the individual is God and the highest thing and everything's about me. And this just, to me, it's, well, there's some amazingly bright young people out there. I've heard it, some people say that this is the first generation or culture that believes in nothing. And if our highest goal is to learn how to play video games online, I am sorry to say we have spiraled into a pretty bad scenario as a culture.
Okay.
Thank you.
What do you want to react to that, Patricia Murray?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I want to say two things about it. First of all, I want to react to the video game playing. This is a big question for a lot of parents. you know, how much time do I let my kids devote to this? And the answer is, not all of these games are created equally. Some of them are very elaborate, and they've developed new literacy skills for kids. So, for instance, you know, in some of the more elaborate games, you can spend an hour online and generate the equivalent of 10 pages of text because you're emailing. You know what I mean? And, you know, that's a good exercise. But if it's just grinding on and shoot 'em up, kill, that's you know, intellectual chewing gum for a kid. And it's like anything else. It's, you know, it's not a good idea. But I will also say regarding, you know, I think that people still have a hangover for Generation X. And I think Generation X did show up into the society as feeling very me, and also feeling very sort of privileged. And I think this, what we're seeing in this rising Ren Gen is a different sensibility. So, for instance, we interviewed one guy who, you know, graduated from college right at the point of Katrina, gathered his friends, drove down, you know, to see what they could do, and they actually ended up creating an organization that does pop-up soup kitchens. This has become, they have now been funded by FEMA. It's a $6 million operation, and it's all volunteer-driven, and it's driven by these young people who went down there to make a difference. So, I mean, I look at that, and I say, well, we have to account for that, right?
Yeah, and let me go to Dan in Eau Claire. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd just like to comment on, it's happening out here in the woods here in Eau Claire. I've seen it happen in the last 5 years. A banker here in town, Charlie Grossfuss, helped develop something called Phoenix Park that used to be a toxic waste dump, a magazine called Volume One that's contributing to the arts and kind of showing us the way. Everything's changing here in this little town on the river, and it's great. I mean, it's positive, and I feel bad for the man in Ladysmith, the way he feels about what's going on in his town, but he can make a difference there. It's a small town that he can make a difference in.
Mm-hmm. Patricia Martin, it's small towns are seeing some of this too.
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm so delighted at this caller. You know, I guess it's always good when somebody sort of reinforces your optimism. Mm-hmm. But I think the other thing is true. You know, the fantastic network of Roman roads meant that, you know, the culture could stimulate even the tiniest little villages. And that's what we're seeing in this second renaissance, is that, you know, this is to some extent fed by the internet, that people are no longer feeling isolated. They have access to ideas, they feel empowered by those ideas, and they feel like they want to go out and do something with it.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. Boyd in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Patricia. This is a great show. My question is basically, what do you think of what's happening in Milwaukee? Because, like you, a lot of what you say hits home with me. I had a liberal arts major in philosophy, and I have no regrets about getting it. Regrettably, employers didn't really think the same way, so I went back to school, studied digital art, because I've studied cartooning for so many years. And I think there's a very vibrant art scene in Milwaukee, and what I would like to do is I would like to eventually contribute my time to make it even better and what have you. I think there's still a lot of work that does need to be done, but I do see hope, and a lot of what you said, as I said before, hits home.
Well, I think Milwaukee has an icon for this hope, and that is the Art Museum. I mean, that gorgeous, you know, it is a cathedral to art, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is. It's really something. If I can just comment on that, when I saw this one book at Borders called World's Most Beautiful Cities, they, of course, had some of the various capitals of Europe, London, Paris, Vienna, and way in the back, I kid you not, they had in there Milwaukee, and they made reference to the art museum. So, yeah, you hit the nail right on the head.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just want to point out, that vision was enormous for that town, and it was, you know, it's never easy to raise that kind of money to build that kind of structure, but that process of fundraising was relatively easy because Milwaukeeans were over-ready to have that kind of expression of who they were, to put themselves on the map in that sort of kind of creative way. So that's one indicator. But you said something that really struck me, and that's, you know, you're in animation and you want to make a difference. And I want to point you to this. I want to talk a little bit about, I interviewed the folks at Pixar about, you know, who they're looking for, like who is this creative personality and what kind of role will it play in the workplace. And here's what I learned. They look for two things in an animator. One, you have to be good at drawing. All the there are a lot of candidates who are good at all the technology end, but they're not good at hand drawing, that old-fashioned eye-hand coordination. Mm-hmm. Secondly, they had to be personable. And I said, well, what do you mean by personable? And he said, look, it's like this. We do everything in storyboard. We even do our memos in storyboard. If you're up there and you're jamming on an idea and you draw this out and somebody comes up and draws on top of your drawing and that makes you mad, you can't work here. So just as we've had years and years and years of American youth soccer teaching kids teamwork skills, you could make a huge difference in teaching this younger generation how to take criticism, because they're going to need it in the workplace if they're artists to succeed.
Oh yeah, most definitely. You have to just take criticism as it comes, and I learned that not only in art but also in philosophy. Yeah, because people aren't going to agree with your views.
And in fact, you don't want them to. You want the debate, and this younger generation is not necessarily going to be attuned to that. I mean, you know, there's other research out there and other books written about how it's a generation that has been somewhat coddled. And, you know, I have the experience of one of my clients is the Pacific Northwest Ballet. Peter Boll, who's their artistic director, just tried this experiment. He opened up the rehearsals. And, you know, it's $5 to sit in the rehearsal and watch the dancers, and it's become a sellout. It's developed a cult following, and what he's discovered is people are actually hungry to watch the critique process. And for a dancer, if you're not being critiqued, it means you're invisible, and that's not good, right? So dancers take it very well. And I just think that's an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, Boyd, thanks for the call. We're talking with Patricia Martin. She is author of RenGen, Renaissance Generation, which talks about the rise of the cultural consumer and what it means to businesses, the marketplace in general, and to communities. We welcome your thoughts and questions for her. Whether or not you're a cultural consumer or not, you probably are. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. 65% of Americans rank reading for pleasure as their top leisure activity. 68% of the American public are interested in independent film. Nearly half of the general population attends cultural events frequently, once a month or more. More of us attend museums and other cultural sites than all of professional sports combined. Some of the traits of the cultural consumer, we're talking about how this is changing life as we know it and contributing to this Renaissance generation. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you, talking with her guest about whether lobbyists can stop the war in Iraq. Find out more about that after 9. We're talking about the RenGen, the Renaissance Generation. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890 with Patricia Martin, author of this book, president of Lit Lamp Communications Group, which is one of the nation's foremost authorities on the rising marketplace created by the convergence of art, entertainment, education, and business. Kate in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I had one quick observation that I played an online game for quite a while, and I'm sort of older than the kids, but it took me to the point from barely typing to something over 70 words a minute. and got me through my master's thesis. And the other thing is that in teaching, I was starting to just really feel depressed about some of the music that kids were listening to. But last year, the number one selling album was High School Musical. There's been a real shift, and it's been really dramatic. And I'm not sure that some of the powers that be that sell stuff have kept up.
No, in fact, they haven't. And I have to tell you, one of the things that I really feel challenged about when I'm out there talking with, you know, people in big advertising agencies and major corporations is they're finding this really hard to believe. And, you know, for instance, that the average Joe is does not want to be marketed to like they're below average. You know, I also think it shows up in people's in sponsorship portfolios. Sponsorship marketing is sort of how I got into the business, the marketing business. And, you know, even today, 96% of the $23 billion that gets spent on sponsorship gets spent on sporting events.
Yeah, lots of beer commercials on those.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if ever there was a time to diversify your portfolio as a sponsor, this is it.
Yeah, but I mean, well, how are they going to, you know, there's not usually some big televised event from the art museum.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, but here's the other reality. The whole culture, the whole civilization is going toward a more subtle form of advertising. No, and this is all, you know, sort of back to that, it's a dialogue, not a monologue anymore. And so, as a result, anybody who's going to be out there with a real in-your-face ad campaign is not going to succeed no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to adopt this thinking. The whole RemGen approach to marketing is just sort of in line with that thinking.
Yeah, in fact, you talk about things like partnerships where the theater and the, I don't know, the restaurant get together to do some sort of marketing that way?
Yes. Mm. Yeah, it's all sort of a lifestyle approach where you tap into somebody's lifestyle. And, you know, I think one of the most interesting people I met in my journey, you know, this was sort of the equivalent of, you know, an intellectual equivalent of climbing Mount Everest, writing this book.
Mm-hmm.
But a guy I encountered, Hugh Gaskins, was at Reebok at the time. And he went out when he first took the job as global lifestyle marketer head, and he interviewed kids on, you know, street corners and kids who were playing in, you know, basketball, and asked him about their interests. And what he discovered is they were more interested in their music, their dance, and their poetry than they were in their athletics.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought that message back to Reebok, and they had a hard time with it, obviously, because they're in the, you know, athletic footwear business. So what he did is he began to create a persona around the shoe that was adopting sort of the indie renegade spirit of the mm-hmm. artist, and kind of fusing that with the athlete. And what he resulted in was the I am what I am who I am campaign. That sort of turned the athlete into an artist, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Bob in Fontana. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I definitely see the effects of what you're talking about around me in my own life, but I'm wondering how broad this trend really is, because there are some pretty disturbing statistics on the other side of the equation. I'll just give you a couple quick three. CNN and the Pew Foundation, Pew Research Foundation, did a study in fall of 2005, I think it was, and they found that 59% of people with baccalaureate degrees newly minted, that these people had such poor reading comprehension that they couldn't understand newspaper editorials or credit card offers. And then National Geographic followed up on that with a study on people's sense of geography and found that 4 out of 5 Americans that they served cannot determine the shape of a state. You know, if you show them Ohio on a map but don't tell them it's Ohio, they can't tell you what that state is, let alone tell you where places like Afghanistan and Iran are on a world map. And So I'm wondering, and you know, the American Bar Association does these surveys to see how well people understand their civic institutions and things like the Bill of Rights, and they usually find that 4 out of 5 people can't even tell you, you know, one element of the Bill of Rights. So mm-hmm. is this just kind of an elite group of people who are having a you know, a strong impact on the society, but they really don't represent?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question, and it's an informed question as well, so I appreciate you calling. Here's, you know, I have about 20 things in my head. I have to kind of nugget this down. Mm. Here's the thing. I'm not familiar with the Pew, that recent Pew poll that you refer to, people not being able to understand a credit card offer. But what I do want to say is that you know, things like people understanding geography. I mean, in this, I work in education as well. I have education clients. The research arm of the U.S. Department of Ed is one of our clients. And here's the challenge, is that the way information is being taught in schools is not current with how kids learn anymore. There is a shift that has occurred, and schools haven't kept up. And people in education understand this, and they're grappling to try to figure out, you know, we have this institution of schools, and, you know, Time Magazine did a huge article on this last year. It was a cover story. And so that's a feature of the sort of disconnect. The reality is, for the kids coming up now, they don't really need to memorize practically on a day-to-day basis. If they want to know where Spain is, they go online and they find out. The bigger opportunity is in being able to identify patterns, to analyze, to creatively problem solve. In order to creatively problem solve, you do have to have a lot of information in your head. My research pointed that out. But the way kids are stocking their storehouse of knowledge, the process is different. This is a generation of kids who actually learn through the computer, if that makes sense. And then on the other end, what we're finding is, you know, the boomers, if you will, are sort of relearning things. So I think there's a momentum in this country to sort of redefine education and redefine how we're going to learn. But I do not subscribe to the idea that we are intellectually incompetent at our base as a society.
Thank you, Bob. Charlie in Fitchburg. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, I share an experience which is very interesting. I served in the Oregon School Board for a time and was involved with the Choral Boosters as a chaperone. We take kids on tour to New York. The choir had a chance to perform at Carnegie Hall. We took them on one occasion to St. Louis. They were going to perform at St. Louis Cathedral, and on the way down, we spent the night at Millikan University on gym floor without sleeping bags. It was, or without air mattresses, and it was rather uncomfortable. I was talking to some of the young people to try to get a feel for what they were learning at school that really seemed important, that they felt they would take with them. And one young man made a comment that has really stayed with me. He said, you know, theater and music are the only places in school where I've begun to learn what it means to be human.
Wow.
And I thought, what an incredibly insightful and powerful idea. And it's really true. It's really struck me that in so many ways, much of kids' education is segmented and compartmentalized into 40-minute segments of this or that. And there are few places where kids really have a chance to see all the pieces coming together. And one thing that theater does is it combines elements of literature and psychology and physics and engineering and art in ways that are very tangible, and I think that's one of the real strengths of the arts, is that they do help stimulate the imagination, and they help us grow and understand in a more fundamental feeling way what it really means to be human.
You know, first of all, I just want to congratulate you for being the kind of adult that not only takes that journey with a group of young people, but is sensitive enough to ask that kind of question and then truly listen to the answer. So, you know, hats off to you. I also want to reflect on a recent conversation I had with a CEO of a major software company who was looking overseas to expand and had to decide which, you know, foreign country that they were going to locate their European operation. And what they decided to
use as their criteria was the education system, because what they needed was the kind of thinker who could analyze and understand a variety of languages, for instance, so that they could get to the root of what the code was, because it was a sort of linguistic approach, that they were broad thinkers, that they had a lot of different kinds of experiences. So the school system had to offer things like music and philosophy. And I mean, this really takes us back to a very humanistic approach to education. And that's where they found when they interviewed, you know, once they decided on that criteria and they interviewed the workers, they found that that was, in fact, the best approach. And they were able to, establish their beachhead in Europe.
Let me get John in Verona on. Hi, John.
Yeah, good morning. I'm really, as much as I like this conversation and so forth, I'm really worried by it for the following reason. At the end of the day, what your guest does is she's a marketer. Marketers sell things. Companies hire marketers to figure out the cultural markers, to label them, and to use them to sell things to people that, in the end, most of the people don't really need anyway, and that's why you have to manipulate them through marketing. Now, the problem that I see is that we're conflating art and intellectual pursuit with selling stuff to people that people don't need. And it's bothersome, because intellectual pursuit is not the same thing as marketing research. And, you know, if you're really an artist and you really understand that sort of revolutionary component, you're going to see that you're being manipulated.
Yeah. Patricia Martin, what about his concern?
Yeah, it's. I think it's a genuine concern. It sounds like you're an artist. Is that right?
No.
Oh, okay. There's a...
And I'm afraid we only have a minute to go.
Here's my quick answer to that. I got asked once when I used to work at the Art Institute of Chicago, and I got asked, you know, about the marketing of Monet and, you know, putting Monet images on cups and, you know, making money off that. And here's my answer. You know, if what I get to look at is a lot of people walking around with Monet T-shirts and mugs instead of I'm with stupid, I'll take it any day.
It certainly would be nicer to look at. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Patricia Martin, author of RenGen, Renaissance Generation, The Rise of the Cultural Consumer and What It Means to Your Business. She is also the president of Lit Lamp Communications Group in Chicago. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening. And tune in tomorrow for the Week in Review after 8 o'clock. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.